The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, everybody. I was waiting for a moment of silence. For those of you who don't know me and that I don't know, my name is Jeanna Madinat. I am the Vice President of the WCL chapter of the National Security and Law Society. And I don't know how many of you were at our first meeting about a month ago, so I'm going to give my little summary of what we do, if any of you weren't there. The primary goal of the National Security and Law Society is to heighten awareness of pretty much any and all issues related to national security and the law, and we really try to do this from a nonpartisan perspective. We sponsor speakers and programs throughout the year, and we provide great networking events for students. And I am proud to announce the National Security and Law Society is now officially an international organization. We have chapters all over the United States and Canada. And after today's event, our next event is going to be October 28th. It is a CLE seminar for government lawyers. It's entitled Ethical Issues for Government Lawyers. And the important thing to remember about that type of an event is it's going to be mostly professionals. They're actually going to be paying to come here and get their CLE credits, so it's a really great networking opportunity if any of you can make it. It's a Friday from 9 to 12, yes. And it's here in room 524. And if any of you guys are interested in joining, you're not already members, you want more information, you ask myself or Brad Moss, who is our chapter president, or you can email NSLS at wcl.american.edu, or you can check out our website. Now, two more relevant things. Today's primer on public diplomacy and national security policy will be taught by the Honorable Jill Shooker. Ms. Shooker is an international consultant heading her own company. In the past, she has served as Special Assistant to President Clinton for National Security Affairs, both as the Deputy Communications Director at the White House and also Senior Director for Public Affairs at the National Security Council. In government, she's also served at the Department of Commerce, the Department of State, the U.S. mission to the United Nations, and on Capitol Hill. In the private sector, she's represented governments, and she's been very involved in helping, governments in transition as they build civil society. Ms. Shooker has worked especially with women on building, developing leadership and communication skills in Latin America, Europe, Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and she's served on their task force on public diplomacy. She also is a member of the Public Diplomacy Council and on the Senior Advisory Council of Business for Diplomatic Action. I've had the honor and pleasure of working with Ms. Shooker for the past year, and I've really learned a lot from her and from her experience, and I think now that it's only fair that you guys have the opportunity to hear from her as well. So listen up, you're going to learn something new.
I hope so. Brad, thank you, and thank you, Jeanna. That's a really nice introduction. And I'm really happy to be with you all today, and I know that there are those who are plugged in or will be somehow, so hello to you all. Public diplomacy is both old and new, and I think what we're going to focus on today and what I'd like to talk with you about, and since we're a sort of small group within this room, if there is something that doesn't quite sound right or is confusing, please feel free to ask me a question. I know we'll have time for that after I speak in any case. But I'm really pleased to be here, and I think it's a great idea that you have this particular organization of National Security and Law Society. I've actually been at a couple of interesting meetings in the last 2 days, and one yesterday was with Cardinal McCarrick, who is the Archbishop of Washington, and he was speaking on Vatican foreign policy. This is part of something at the Council on Foreign Relations, talking about religion, the sort of interface of religion and foreign policy. And a comment that he made, which was interesting and timely and relevant to what we're talking about today, is that the U.S. is hurting in terms of perceptions around the world. Specifically, he was referring to the issues of Abu Ghraib and prisoner abuse and interpretations and perceptions of the United States. today, I was at a meeting this morning, which two former officials, Republican and Democratic, were speaking, one being Carla Hills, who had been the one of our early trade representatives under Jerry Ford, President Ford, and Jamie Gorelick, who you may be more familiar with of late, but she had served just recently on the 9/11 Commission, but during the Clinton administration had been Deputy Attorney General under Janet Reno. And this particular conversation was talking about bipartisan foreign policy, or in essence the lack thereof at the moment. And the comments that were made this morning, again in a group setting such as this, was the concerns of not just issues at home in terms of perceptions of Americans about how we are dealing with policy issues abroad, but also clearly very much about how we are perceived abroad in terms of our policies at home. And there was agreement from both of these very articulate women and public servants that polarization has just reached an extraordinarily bad and difficult and negative level. And Carla Hills mentioned that it seems as though there is now, in the common parlance, with districts that are represented in Congress, too much blue and too much red, whereas the redistricting of old did not seek, certainly as actively or let's say even as successfully, to have districts that were so polarized. And therefore you have people coming into Congress now, separate from the executive branch, but people coming into Congress who are representing in many ways more narrowly focused districts. And what has happened, therefore, is that there is less of a propensity toward moderation. So where does all this sort of translate into public diplomacy? Part of it is that America's voice abroad is really very reflective of how America's voice is shaped at home. And if you have polarization and you have a lack of dialogue at home, and I think for many of you who clearly are here now in law school, first year, second year, third year, but let's say over the past few years, some of you may be particularly aware only of the Bush presidency, somewhat of Clinton through high school, but it has been a very polarizing period in American foreign policy. And as someone who has a considerable number of years, whether I like to admit to them or not, I have gone through a number of presidents, starting really with, I guess, my active interest in time in terms of current events, really starting with John Kennedy. There have been periods that have been very polarizing in foreign policy. Certainly one of them was Vietnam, and it was a long period of time. But I would say this is probably, for me, just about the most polarizing period that I can remember in terms of attitudes about foreign policy, the policies themselves, but reactions to United States policy, which have been about as negative as I remember. And the issue of public diplomacy is really one that deals with both substance as well as image. And I would just say, as we start off this conversation, that if we don't have a civilized debate at home, it's very difficult to think about having a civilized debate abroad with people who have diametrically opposed views, who don't come out of even the roots that we do here in the United States with similar learning curves and backgrounds and ethical understandings. So we really need to be thinking about how we dialogue and beginning here at home if we're going to be effective abroad. And sort of understanding divergencies, but focusing on dialogue. So all of this is directly related, as I said, to U.S. foreign policy and the conduct of what has really come to be known as public diplomacy. Not terminology that was used all that much even 10 years ago, but some of this has to do with the definition that has been given to the work and the actual office in government that is called public diplomacy. I'll get back to that a little later. But it's really also how it meshes with national security policy, which I know, of course, is a very basic interest here. First, I guess I would say, you know, what is public diplomacy? And I define it as the way we project what is the American vision and voice. And it really operates in the marketplace of ideas abroad. It is closely connected to foreign policy. But the question really is public diplomacy something that can be policy neutral? And that is a very difficult and provocative question, and I will get back to that. So public diplomacy really is how we attract, persuade, educate, dialogue, communicate, understand, learn from, and engage peaceably conflict resolution through dialogue with publics overseas, globally, and to do so and project really what America is about. And what do I mean by that? And I'm choosing my words carefully. I mean values, principles, ideas, actions, culture. It means discourse, and it means going beyond specific government and policy channels. In other words, beyond the public sector. Effective public diplomacy is America's opportunity to define itself. It's a tool in the arsenal as military, economic, other kinds of public policy, actions, mechanics, and ideas. Now, some people may not agree with some of what I will talk to you about today, but this is my view of what public diplomacy should be, but isn't always. Public diplomacy, or our projection, as I say, of America's vision and voice is really challenged by other philosophies and ideologies. What we really need to be doing is developing a strategy for winning the famous or infamous, certainly during Vietnam, sort of hearts and minds. Issue that has been discussed, that phrase that was a very provocative one, one that was used by Lyndon Johnson a lot during Vietnam, and this whole issue of winning hearts and minds and how we go about it. But it springs from the unique roots that is America, or that are America. And we have to also remember that it takes place in real time and is buffeted by real events. And the real time and real events are not just sort of the ideal of America's voice and vision, but what the actual policies are. So I go back again to this question, is it possible to have a policy-neutral public diplomacy? And I would say it is difficult, but it is necessary. So what where does that take us, or where does that take me? What I am really saying in that regard is that I believe that being a spokesman for policy, for a specific policy, is not specifically the role of the Office of Public Diplomacy, i.e., it is not what Karen Hughes or Charlotte Beers or Margaret Tutwiler in the 5 months that she was in the job. It's not really the job of that office. It is the job of Scott McClellan, and it is the job of Sean McCormick, who is the spokesman at the White House. But the role of the person who heads public diplomacy is a different kind of role. It is to talk about what U.S. policy is, but it is not necessarily to advocate, in my view, a specific policy. It is to be able to say, yes, there is a lot of disagreement at home about our policy on Iraq. There are real questions about the philosophy behind this. And it is different than saying this is what America was founded as. We all have heard the president in the last couple of days. I mean, if you know, the word strictly was used, 9,000 times when he was introducing Harriet Myers. You know, is it a living document? Is the Constitution a living document, or is it one that does have a very strict constructionist interpretation? There are clearly differences at home. And I think part of the strength of America is to project that there are these differences, and we do discuss these things at home, and that these are some of the questions that those who we are interested in attracting to the way and America thinks and what we were brought up to view as the dialogue that takes place at home is really part of what will attract those abroad to thinking and being exposed to the panoply of possibilities and ideas abroad. I think it's important to realize that we can't and don't want to confuse publics abroad. There is a subtlety that I think growing up in America enables us to develop and understand that can't necessarily be appreciated by cultures that have been brought up with a very structured point of view. I remember when I first, probably before many of you were born, but when I went to what was then the Soviet Union in 1979, I went with a group called the American Council of Young Political Leaders, and as you may know, young political leaders in the Soviet Union were considerably older than young political leaders here, since the level of leadership was usually considerably older than our leadership here. But the two things that struck me really profoundly, one of them was how deeply rooted the imagery of the Second World War was, which seemed to me to be eons away in 1979, and was, but now even more so. But the public at that time, and this was young people, younger people, as well as those who had fought and lived through the war. There were 20 million Soviets who were killed. I mean, it was a profound structural and emotional abuse to the psyche of the Soviet public. And there was a sense that America really didn't get it in terms of how profound that had influenced and shaped thinking in the society, and it was an eye-opener for me, being exposed to that kind of thinking. Even though I had, you know, sat in the classroom, as you all have, and learned history and all of that. The second thing which really struck me was that we have really been brought up in this country to think for ourselves, to question. We're told something and, you know, the favorite, why? You know, why is that the case? What does that mean? Why do you believe that and someone else believes something else? That is not the way at that time in that society people were taught. The view was leadership always knows better, and of course given the strict KGB and other things that were part of the society at the time, I mean, you better believe a certain way. But it was also a way of being brought up, and it was part of the unity of the society. So for those of us who were there, and there were maybe 20 of us, and it was an interesting group. One person has went on to be governor. Another person was mayor in Ohio and Cleveland for a number of years. Attorney general in another state. I mean, it was, we were all, I would say, 20s, 30s at that time. It was profoundly interesting to be exposed to this concept that when the people sitting across the table from us spoke, it was, well, we think, or the society believes. Very, very different than the way certainly I was brought up, and I assume you were all brought up, in terms of the kind of schooling that you're getting right now and that you have gotten in your life. So to be able to really understand this sort of groupthink, one really does need to begin, again, here at home, to have the kind of dialogue, to challenge not only our public officials, but each other, and then to really understand what is happening abroad in terms of ideas. And part of that is not just what you get out of books, but traveling, learning other languages. You know, how does public diplomacy, in a sense, really effectively happen? And one of the issues to think about is who are the players in the centers of influence. I've spent a lot of my career in government, and I have also worked, as I am now, in the private sector. Washington is, I'm sure many of you know, I'm sure some of you here have interned or been on Capitol Hill or worked in law offices. So much of what one thinks about here is public policy. It's an island in many ways. You know, you all, I'm sure, come from many different parts of the country. And there are many other elements beyond the public sector that play a very significant role in public policy and public diplomacy and public policy. And I think as those of you who have traveled abroad, and I'm sure, I mean, has anybody not been abroad in this room? You haven't. You will, though, I'm sure. Do you want to?
Probably.
Well, I hope you do. Probably. You'll have to come back and tell me why you're not sure. But the importance of exposure to other cultures, and when you have traveled, I am sure that some of the perceptions that you've confronted, and I assume many of you have traveled more recently, part of it is very much reflective of the policies that the United States is projecting abroad and following. But some of it also is that the sort of images of America, one has to do with the president and what our policies are, as I've said, but the other is this sort of, you know, McDonaldization, if that's the way to phrase it, whether you're in China or whether you're in Germany or wherever you may be. The front line in many ways of those abroad who interact with Americans, it is through business, and it is through the private sector. So the private sector plays an extremely important role, and that means lawyers, it means corporate actors, it means students who travel, it means the media. There are many centers of influence, NGOs, think tanks, and thinking about what those perceptions are and how we project ourselves and how we interact. I mean, so many people, and this has happened, I think, increasingly because of the tremendous security concerns abroad, is that you find Americans, in a sense, living in enclaves. I mean, I'm old enough and have worked on Capitol Hill at a time when I remember, literally, you would go, you know, I'd leave the Cannon House office building and walk into the Capitol, and you'd walk into the Capitol. I mean, that was what you do. And sure, I mean, we had IDs, but it was a very free-flowing communication, both in terms of bodies back and forth, I mean, just people traffic, but also that created, I think, a mindset, too. There was a free flow of people and ideas and information. Again, at this meeting this morning, the comment was that the issue of bipartisanship was a much more sort of taken for granted sort of natural state of being. That is not the natural state of being now. Perhaps some of you would disagree with me, but it is just simply not. There is a tremendous contentiousness, and it is that sense, again, that there is, you know, a sort of one way of thinking, which does not, I believe, you know, help the perceptions of what it is we're trying to say about our country when we are dealing with many different kinds of views abroad. When you go and visit embassies now, you know, and I'm not criticizing this because I think some of this has happened definitionally, but it's sort of like entering an armed camp. I mean, it is very hard to talk about a flow of information and an ease of information when it is really tremendously difficult not just to sort of see an embassy abroad that enables an ease of communications, but where there is a very much a sense of sort of we and they, and a difficulty, whether it's visa policy or other things, in terms of getting into the country. So we need to massage and deal with these centers of influence in a much more effective way. And part of it, too, in terms of policy and public diplomacy, is are we organized to be effective? Part of the issue is, I think Jumana has heard me say this before, but you know, if you're really going to be effective on policy, you need to be there for the takeoff as well as the landing. If we're going to create a policy about Iraq, or we're going to create a policy, I mean, fill in the blank, whether it's China, whether it is UN reform, whatever it is, one needs to take into consideration how the policy is going to be effected and understood and appreciated abroad. And, hi, please sit down if you're here for this. And I think that there is a sense that Joe Nye at Harvard, who has written a book called Soft Power, has called, soft power. I personally, and I think Joe's great and has tremendous understanding of this whole area, but there is, in my view, a problem with the terminology soft power. because it is viewed, and certainly I think in the sort of partisan battles, Democrats are often accused, I think, of being soft as opposed to understanding and appreciating the sort of hard power issues of diplomacy. And therefore, I think that it's an unfortunate word because it is misused and abused, perhaps, by those who want to point to saying, well, this is not a really important tool in the arsenal. Or it is just one, you know, if we must. But of course, this at one time was how human rights was understood when Jimmy Carter became the first president who had an assistant secretary for human rights. And of course now, human rights has, you know, over many years become a very essential piece of understanding what is an important diplomatic, not just tool, but something that must be considered in terms of a whole range of policy issues. So I think part of it is an educative process here at home. And I was struck earlier this year by Cheney, who I think no one would accuse of being sort of a soft power guy, in perhaps a misunderstood use of the term of soft power, but who said that we have real issues in this country where we have not fully used and understood the importance and the value of public diplomacy, and it has been and this was his word, weak part of the arsenal, and it has to be changed. Now, you know, I would say, and I think that there is now sort of a baseline understanding, that public diplomacy is necessary for effective national security policy. And there must be, in terms of the way policy is made internally in government, there must be a seat at the table. I think the value of Karen Hughes having the relationship that she does with the president is that she will have a seat at the table. I think the first person who was in this job in the Bush administration, Charlotte Beers, did not have a seat at the table. And also, I think, did not, and this is not meant to be personal, because she had a tremendous understanding of how the private sector dealt and deals with issues abroad. But it is a different world when you enter government, and I think if you enter it at a high level without really understanding how it functions, it was and with an administration, certainly at that point, that I think had little appreciation for the importance of it. And remember, this was pre-9/11 and pre-Iraq, and with a president who was himself a neophyte in terms of foreign policy. If you remember, that was the whole issue of Cheney on the ticket and such. It was a different time. And Charlotte Beers, in that particular role, I would say, I think bipartisanly one would say, had a very difficult time, and it was not a successful period. And she talked a lot about branding America. It is not a terminology that I'm comfortable with, but it's also not something that I think America is. I mean, I don't think America is a brand. I think, again, without being redundant, it goes back to, you know, what is public diplomacy? It's a vision and its values. And I think if it's projected as a brand as opposed to understanding the complications of policy and such, it is doomed to not be effective because it is a projection and it's one way as opposed to this issue of dialogue. I have a sort of going back and forth here, but I think many of you probably have heard of the movie, you know, Cool Hand Luke, but there was, you know, the line in that, there was some program a couple of months ago about the famous lines in movies, but the one that came out of that was, you know, what we have here is a failure to communicate, but it's a true line that I think is one that one needs to really incorporate and think about in terms of public diplomacy. And you all, as lawyers, I think, need to really be thinking about what are the pieces in terms of public diplomacy. Please come in. I don't know if people, I guess, are they concerned about entering once this has started? That's fine. But what are the kinds of things that, again, that the United States can be doing to project what are these issues of both vision and voice and values, and what has really created the America that in many ways we're most proud of? And one of them is certainly rule of law, which is a very important piece of what the United States can bring abroad, and it is relevant in so many different ways in societies, whether it's rule of law in terms of human rights, in terms of elections, in terms of basic rules and regulations governing everything from banking to private sector issues to trade. There is a very important role that I think we all play in whatever role we will perform professionally, public sector and private sector, in terms of public diplomacy. And I guess, you know, my message, in a sense, is that while some of you may be perhaps sitting here and saying, well, what does this really have to do with, you know, our particular portfolio as a lawyer, I think it has a tremendous amount, not only in terms of as you think about what you need to be doing as you think about policy issues and public policy and corporate law and the way we project abroad, but also how you think about an issue that you're going to be dealing with here at home. What are the elements beyond sort of the specific definitions? What are the other elements that need to be brought into the thinking about how law operates and how one thinks about it? The issue, I guess I would just say on a few other points. The Middle East, for example, just to go to a very specific issue, and the issue of Palestinian-Israeli relations, has always been a very volatile issue in this country, certainly I would say since before the, or perhaps at the time of the founding of Israel, but certainly from the 40s onward, and from the UN vote. There may be different ways of having thought about that issue, of dealing with the issue. Certainly every president has in the United States has been involved in this from Harry Truman on. But some of this is clearly being dealt with in a different way now. And what I mean is from, you know, we've sort of gone from stones and hijackings with planes being taken over but landed to this tragedy of suicide bombings and other issues. And much of it, I mean, it has certainly related to issues beyond specifically Middle East in terms of Israel and Palestine. But there is, I would say, whether it was Karen Hughes' recent trip or other issues, that always seems to be a thread that sort of wanders through the concerns that deal with public diplomacy. If it wasn't Iraq, then the United States clearly has not been viewed as being, whether it's even-handed or whatever, on the Middle East. And I would say that part of what we need to do, again, is to, it's not a matter of convincing people, as I don't think some people certainly here in the United States will be convinced of other views on policy. But it is, again, to project in some ways a, when it comes to public diplomacy, an opportunity to dialogue on issues, and including the Middle East, including Iraq. Again, for a couple of you who weren't here, it is the spokesman's job at the White House to project what is the administration's view, and, you know, in that sense, America's view on Iraq, on the Middle East, on WMD, weapons of mass destruction, or whatever. But that is not the role of what I believe the person who heads public diplomacy should be doing. And I actually, in terms of the Karen Hughes' recent trip, and I only know what I've read in the paper, but I believe that while it is very difficult to stand up in front of a room and have people criticize your country in terms of its policy, I believe that her role should be one of accepting that there are different views on policy issues, as opposed to saying and defending, in a certain sense, whether it's Iraq policy or whatever else. And I think there has been, again, a misunderstanding about what I believe the role of public diplomacy should be. And I think if we get into an issue, as I said earlier, and again, it's this polarization, that if you can't question certain policies, which is a bottom line fundamental tenet of what the United States is all about, then I really don't see how we can effectively persuade people on policy, because it basically says we're not willing to listen. I guess I would just, in a few more moments, just say that I think that the role of the messenger is very important, and whether it is the messenger abroad, in terms of our embassies and ambassadors themselves, whether it is the private sector, whether it is those who are attending policy conferences, whether it is you who are dialoguing with other students, whether it is legal seminars, whatever, it is extremely important that I think we both project what our views are, but also listen. And most importantly, it's issues of credibility and integrity. And I think this is where we have had problems whenever we've had them along the way. You know, there's the famous, and many of you may have heard of it, some of you may not have, comment that when, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, our then ambassador to the United Nations went to speak to Charles de Gaulle to show him the pictures of what was going on in Cuba and the missiles being assembled, et cetera, and so forth. He went to show these to de Gaulle, and de Gaulle said, if the president says this, his word is good enough. Well, you know, with due respect, I think there has been a a real blow to our credibility. In many instances, happily, many may be too strong a term, but certainly in certain instances, but we have certainly seen it recently. And I think when Colin Powell says that he will, as he did in some interview a month or so ago that I read, that, you know, I will be forever remembered for getting up in front of the United Nations. You were shaking your head, Matt. Maybe you had seen that. I mean, Colin Powell's credibility was hurt. The United States' credibility was hurt. And it is very difficult to go around and say, believe me, you know, trust me, take my word for it. It has, and I don't have to go through some of the issues on Iraq and such that we've all been exposed to, but it has damaged us. And I think when someone, a young woman who I had taught a class at Fletcher last year, and she said to me, well, can you really blame Charlotte Beers for perhaps an ineffective reign as a public head of public diplomacy, because things changed so dramatically before 9/11 and after 9/11. And, you know, and she sort of threw a rock into that too. And what I would say is that effective public diplomacy, in my view, should not be policy specific. It should be able to, for the United States, it has something to do with who we believe we are and how we were trained and how we think about policy. And, you know, I'm being very redundant about this, but I really think it is very basic to what public diplomacy is. So much of this is not just the message, but the messengers. And it can't just be a la Adlai Stevenson, you know, I take your word for it anymore. And I think we have a lot of rebuilding that we have to do. And it's quite serious. And it's really going to be not just on my watch, but even much more so on your watch over these next 40, 50, whatever years, when, you know, you are running the country. Bill Clinton, who was a contemporary of mine, and I guess, you know, now Bush, and, you know, many people at this age. I mean, it's really very interesting. I never thought I'd quite feel this at the time, but when Clinton came into office, it was really weird to sort of think, gee, you know, we're there now. I mean, this is kind of my crowd, and not just as a Democrat, but in terms of the age group. So, I mean, there is a lot to really be very attuned to in terms of both the listening and the ability to communicate. And as effective, and I believe we've hardly had somebody as effective as Bill Clinton. I mean, one talks a lot about Reagan, too, but Clinton was so smart and such an effective articulator, and in the last part of his presidency was so damaged in terms of personal issues and what had happened that I think America also began to lose its voice because he was not able to be as effective as he had been early on in his presidency. So, I mean, the damage really can be done, and I think we need to think about that a lot. Just to finish up, there was a few things that I wanted to say. When Margaret Tutwiler, who was in the job for a very short amount of time in public diplomacy job, and who had been our ambassador to Morocco, had worked with James Baker during Bush One, and very talented. She's actually now at the American Stock Exchange. There was a comment that she had made, which when I had seen her afterwards, a number of months later, she said, I didn't think that was on the record, but what she said was, she was asked by Congressman Colby when she was testifying about public diplomacy on the Hill, and he said, you know, you mentioned a number of important things here today, you know, Ambassador Tutwiler. What is your reaction when you tell all this to the White House? And she said, well, I don't say it to the White House because it wouldn't be well received. Well, that was sort of, that may be why she was a short-termer. But I also think that there was really a lack of understanding and commitment and appreciation. And I, you know, with all due respect to Karen Hughes, who I think is a very effective public official, but, you know, what was the message when she was named in March and didn't do her confirmation hearing for 5 or 6 months later because she went back to Texas, and so the story goes, and so she said, because she wanted to wait till her son graduated and all of this. A perfectly understandable motherly instinct, but what does that say about the importance that we're giving to something that the vice president says is a weak part of our arsenal, and the job is left vacant for months and months? So, I mean, there are conflicting messages here, and I think we need to be much more attuned to that. It is also underfunded. What is the message when we have a visa policy, and we all understand, you know, what sort of was pulled back after 9/11, but with due respect, we are 4 years down the road, and it is very difficult for people of certain persuasions to come into this country. People who have backgrounds in Arabic, as I know Jumana does, who have real skills that are needed, are not as easily as they once were, I think, welcomed into government. The background and the sort of hoops that one has to go through, having gone through many of them myself when I went into government, the background checks and such are just, you know, unbelievable now. And, you know, if you are someone of a certain background and have relatives abroad or in certain countries, it is very difficult. And those are the people who in many ways are needed desperately, not just here at home, but abroad. And, you know, there is, which I haven't really gotten into, a very important role, too, for the press. And with due respect, and I always love seeing all the computers open, because, I mean, I know it sounds like the dark ages, but when I went to school, there were no computers. And, I mean, you know, I typed away and all of that. Well, you know, when you go into class and if somebody had something open, i.e. a newspaper or whatever, it'd be viewed as rude. I mean, I have no idea if someone's doing a video game. I presume not. But what I'm saying is that, you know, it's a whole different way of communicating now. I mean, this whole iPod thing that we're doing today, blogging. I mean, the way of getting information is really fabulous and not extraordinary anymore, but there are so many different kinds of opportunities and outreach. But we can't just operate through newspapers. I mean, as Jumana knows, I'm a great newspaper reader. I still love the feel of newspaper print, and I like to read full stories, and I just like reading that way, and maybe it's because I'm used to it. And I read a lot of newspapers a day. But I would just say to you that it is a tragedy that bureaus abroad are closing. Again, it's the loss of the intimacy of understanding and being part of cultures abroad. And it's sort of like, I mean, I hope we never reach a point where we have campaigns, particularly presidential campaigns, that are all just, in my view, computerized voting or whatever else. There's something about getting out there and connecting with the public that is part of what this country is all about. But it is not part of what every country is all about, which is part of what I think we also need to understand about you can't impose or export democracy in easy ways, and you certainly can't do it without understanding other cultures. There is just simply, in my view, no way of really doing that effectively. There is a line that I love, and some of you may be aware of it. I had worked for Ron Brown when he was Secretary of Commerce, and Ron was then killed very tragically during the Clinton administration in a plane crash in Croatia. But Ron used to quote Wayne Gretzky, and I've sort of adopted that. And he would say, when Gretzky was asked, what makes you, you know, the fantastic, unique hockey player you are, and he said, because I skate to where the puck will be. And I always think that's such a great quote, because it's not where I think it'll be or where I hope it'll be or where, you know, but it's where it will be. Now, not everybody can skate to where the puck will be. I mean, this guy had a sixth sense, clearly, and was as effective as he was. But I think it's something that's very useful to keep in mind, because the question is, where will the puck be? We know that we have, in the United States, deep issues dealing with the Islamic world, with very little understanding and very little real development of understanding here at home, much less abroad. But what about China? What about the languages that we are not, and the communities that we are not attuned to? And I'm not, you know, saying China is well, I am saying China, I think, is certainly an area of the world that we need to have much better understanding of. But there is a clearly a difference in understanding Asia than there is in the Islamization of so much of what we are having trouble understanding as Americans, culturally and otherwise. But we really need to be thinking about when your kids one day, or you all now, are going to school, what are the kinds of skills in terms of your legal education and other things that are the right combinations that are really going to make you all ready for the future that is, you know, that is upon us? And I guess, you know, just a couple of other quick things. I would just say there's this line, too, that I've always liked, and there was actually a book that Kerry Kennedy, I think, had written called Speak Truth to Power. And I think that's very important. It's something that we are, again, are able to do here. And it's something that I think effectively public diplomacy can and should do. And a failure of public diplomacy is that if we're not speaking truth to power, but also speaking truth to the street, in a sense, you know, we've all sort of become familiar with this terminology of the Arab street, but it's the publics that are out there. It's the people who still very much want to come to this country to be educated. If we all grow up, as I think we have over a number of years now, with generations or a generation of people your age who have had no exposure to Americans, no exposure to a Western education, who aren't being taught here, unlike those who of a much older generation who are educated here and are the teachers, but are no longer, you know, are now sort of moving out of the mainstream of their professional lives. There's going to be very little symbiosis and understanding. So, national security policy, public diplomacy. I think they are absolutely necessarily integrated. I don't think that we can have an effective national security policy without an effective public diplomacy policy and without effective people who understand the interface and the interplay of both of those pieces. So thank you very, very much. And thank you for having me.
Anybody has any questions?
Well, let me, which I didn't get into, but let me just say that the United States Information Agency, which was first headed, I think maybe it was the second head, at least it was under John Kennedy, was Edward R. Murrow. And you probably know the name and, you know, mostly through the McCarthy period when, among other exposés that, that Murrow did, not while he was at USIA, but while he was in his previous life on CBS. But USIA was created really to do the public diplomacy function. And it was very, I think, well regarded. Like many things, it depends on who runs the function and what the opinions are. But I think over time, it retreated to a more of a backwater, particularly, I would say, after the Cold War. I think during the Cold War, there was always this, you know, tension of the importance of sort of American speak and who we are, and it was a real ideological clash. Francis Fukuyama, whose name you, some of you again may know, you know, wrote at one point, you know, it's the end of history. I never quite got it, but be that as it may, I think that there was a, and he's a highly respected thinker, policy person. There were a lot of people who viewed it that way after the Soviet Union basically imploded, and the utility of public diplomacy and USIA, I think, was sort of viewed as, well, we no longer, you know, everybody loves America. I mean, you know, here we are, the whole world is going to beat a path to our door. Well, as we know, guess what? And what happened, which was really a political compromise, and I think many people view it not as a particularly good one, although at the time it seemed to be sort of good deal, but sort of a deal with the devil. When Jesse Helms was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations, Committee during a period of Clinton's presidency, when Madeleine Albright was Secretary of State, there was a big issue, which there seems to be every year, but a big issue about paying UN dues. And the basic deal was, I mean, I'm breaking it down to the very bare minimum, was, okay, we'll go for the payment of the dues, but we basically want to do away with USIA. And that's really what happened. And USIA was homogenized, or was miniaturized, I guess, was probably the better word, into the Office of Public Diplomacy at the State Department. And there are, as I, well, maybe I didn't say, but the spokesmen who are Foreign Service officers, and many of whom had been at USIA and are now sort of, in a sense, part of the State Department, are the officers who also have dealt with, who make sure that the spokesman at the State Department has their guidance every day. Well, what's happened is that they really are wearing two hats in my view. They're wearing the hat which says, this is what the policy is, this is, you know, what we're going to say today about selling, F-16s to Taiwan or fill in the blank. But they're also, now, and Karen Hughes has recently said this, she has basically given them a public diplomacy function. My sense is that it's complicated, and I don't know if I was sitting in the job how I would do it exactly, but I think there are different roles. I think it is vitally important that the Foreign Service be very integrated into the public diplomacy function, and that has happened to some extent. Friends of mine who have been ambassadors more recently, in the last 10 years, let's say, have a very different kind of training. They do on security concerns too, I might add, as you can imagine, but they have a very different kind of training in terms of how to deal culturally, particularly in the Islamic world. But there is, but they're also more isolated. And it's a real tension between a friend of mine who was ambassador to Cyprus. I mean, what Don Bandler, for example, wanted to do, and I think some of what he was able to do. So certainly the Foreign Service is one piece of this, but I'm not sure that there shouldn't be another kind of cadre as well, and I don't want to overly bureaucratize, you know, more and more people, but I think there ought to be utility, actually, let's even say outside of public service per se, but, you know, people who are retiring, who have tremendous language skills, or who have lived abroad, who, there's a group called Business for Diplomatic Action, actually, I'm going to a meeting tomorrow, where it's a lot of people who have been in the private sector who want to be involved, you know, sort of like a when I say a grown-up, I mean, because people would be older, Peace Corps kind of thing, but not Peace Corps per se. But anyway, I think there are a lot of ways of having a much more resilient and dynamic living kind of experience. Yes, sir.
My question is going to be more along the lines of comparing how it perhaps would have worked when you were working for President Clinton, and the way it seems to have worked in the Bush administration. When I was in the Army in 2002. I was in Korea,
mm-hmm.
and I was there at the time when two little girls were run over by a convoy, a military convoy. There were some problems with the procedure of the convoy, and they didn't. Problem with communication. So when the first, truck went past the little girls, they didn't tell the people in the back that had, and so there was this accident.
Right.
Two little girls died. This was right after or near the time when President Bush had, according to the South Koreans, embarrassed President Kim Dae-jung when he came to Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly, the source of the embarrassment was that President Bush kind of took that time to announce that he was no longer going to engage on Korea, and seemed to implicitly criticize in front of President Kim Dae-jung his sunshine policy. And anyway, so what ended up happening, being a soldier over there, and obviously it was a soldier maneuver that killed these two girls, I understood kind of the irritant was that the soldiers responsible would not be brought to the Korean court as part of the status of forces agreement and already been established. And I think that what people were crying for in the South Korean press and whatnot was an apology,
right.
and some type of sense of justice or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the president was late in apologizing. In fact, never apologized directly, but sent like a low-level diplomat to apologize way late.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in this particular instance it kind of shows the perception of arrogance on the part
right.
of the U.S. As well as perhaps if you want to take a fair view, just basically that certain types of information don't get to the president, and sometimes it takes the president to plug a hole or to work the kind of curious contrast with how it might have worked with y'all's team.
Well, you know, I would just say I think that, you know, the arrogance of power, clearly we've heard that expression a lot even, you know, at home, but I think that it's something that the U.S. has to be particularly sensitive to because, you know, in some ways we are the big kid on the block and in some ways the only one sometimes on the block. And it's very easy to throw our weight around. You know, even in some of the dire issues that we may have at home, there is still, you know, sort of bestride the world like a colossus kind of thing. And I think to pull ourselves back and to have that cultural sensitivity is extremely, extremely important. The Korea issue, and I remember that, but not as well as probably I should, but I know there was also the issue of rapes in Korea, not during the time perhaps you were there, but I know during the Clinton administration, there were two different periods in which, and I can't remember exactly where it was, it's just escaping me, but it was in Korea, and a similar kind of concern. You know, these issues of status of forces agreements and memorandums of understanding and, you know, we do have troops elsewhere and, you know, who can be heard in what courts, as you know, there are, which of course has not endeared us either to some countries and people abroad, is that there are international covenants and treaties that we do not subscribe to, and yet, you know, we certainly think a lot of other people ought to, and don't want to be subject, or don't want our troops subject to certain ones. I think those things are sort of de rigueur. I mean, that is going to be the you know, the immovable object and the irresistible force. I mean, we're not going to get around some of that. But the ways of of dealing with that and the way we explain ourselves, I think, is extremely important. And I do think we have dealt arrogantly and turned aside on issues, and not just in this particular administration, but elsewhere. I mean, it took Clinton a long time to deal, and I was there during, you know, the administration on Rwanda. I mean, it was an absolute horrendous tragedy, and we, you know, among others, pulled out, and you know, and Clinton, I think, clearly, but it was after his presidency that he came back, and maybe it was during the last term, and said, we made a mistake, and of course that was in the wake of what had happened in Somalia when we had, you know, the, you know, Black Hawk down and all of that. So, I mean, you know, there are times where there is a context, and we are not going to be, I mean, there's no way we're going to be perfect, but I think to be consistent in some ways, to talk about, you know, to be talking about global warming and then to basically upend a treaty that we had supported, I don't think that endeared us, nor do I think that we were credible. And it was one of the very first decisions, you know, that was made, and it was one of the things that I think put us in some ways behind an international eight ball to begin with. And I feel like I'm sounding very partisan here. There have been issues, as I said, you know, that I think every administration can take their lumps on. But I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, we do have an electorate here. We do elect every 4 years, and there are certain policies that the electorate may or may not agree with, but certain policies will be made, and, you know, the country, this is how we work in this country, we follow through. But I think to say that, you know, that when we go abroad that there is, you know, this issue of disagreement stops at the water's edge, there is validity to that because we are representatives of our country. But to say that there is no disagreement, or rather not to project that there is ample disagreement at home about certain policies, and that, you know, we have the opportunity to change our politics and our policymakers, is one of the advantages, it seems to me, that we can talk about in terms of what the American system is all about. So it's, I mean, it is a complicated dance, but I don't think that it behooves us in terms of what we're trying to show about the flexibility and the openness of America to be walking in lockstep without an appreciation of where we are. And I don't know, you as a soldier, how you felt. I, you know, certainly felt during Vietnam, and I marched and all of that during that time. I was not happy with our policy. But I was always very upset when I heard or saw people being critical of our soldiers, or those who came back to some very unwelcome attitudes here at home. And I think it is complicated. I mean, people, of course, then it wasn't a volunteer army either, and I think it particularly at that time, I mean, people were told to go and fight. I mean, that's what. So, in any case, the definition and how you expand the definition and define it of public diplomacy is actually, you know, part of the challenge. Anyone else? Yes, sir. Well, I mean, it'd be interesting to hear what you all think about that. I mean, I do think that, you know, let's just go back to Vietnam. Vietnam was the enemy, or at least part of Vietnam was the enemy. It was a time when it was not certainly easy to be in this country as a person from Vietnam. I think it's been now, granted it's been a long time, and I think time does do these things. I mean, I remember when I was a little girl seeing some of the movies that were about World War II, or, you know, I mean, or even things as, you know, when we look, as I'm sure you all do, at old movies, I mean, the racial characterizations and stereotypes of the Japanese and all of this. I mean, I think we're in a totally different place now when we think about Japanese, about Vietnamese, and a lot of it has to do with people, young people who've come over here. I mean, it seems so often, you know, you look at some of your best science students or your best math students, I mean, are so many of them are this new wave of immigrants who have come in the last 20 to 30 years. And I think it's very interesting in other ways to look at China. I think there's a, I mean, my sense is, again, I don't know if this is your view, but there is a lot of respect for what, you know, there may not be respect for the kind of society and the repression, of course, and such. There has to still be, you know, some significant change. But what China as a society has been able to do in terms of modernization and privatization, I mean, my sense is there's a lot of respect for sort of the Chinese way or projection into and a sense of understanding. I mean, it was very interesting recently. Some of you may have paid attention to this Unical issue. When there was a question of who was going to buy with Unical, and as you know too, there is a lot of ownership. I mean, one of our issues in this country is how we deal with our debt, because so much of it is owned by China, among others, abroad. So I think there is, I mean, whether people want to think about it or not, I mean, I know it's very tough when members of Congress have to go home and they, you know, an issue like CAFTA, you know, NAFTA, voting for the free trade agreements, and someone says, you know, I'm losing my job because of this. But there is an educative process that people need to have. And I know that doesn't put food on your table right away, but the issue is that to say that we are not going to have trade is simply putting your head in the sand. I mean, we just don't live in that kind of world anymore. And so I think there has been some very effective translation of other cultures here. And a significant need to better understand other cultures abroad, because I do think that there is still a view in America which is, and when I say isolationist, you know, we have 3,000 miles between two oceans, and there is still a sense when I think a lot of people go abroad, what do you mean you don't speak English? There is, you know, one doesn't have to just travel 10 miles a la Europe or even in Asia or other places to be exposed to other languages and other cultures. And here we just sort of, you know, live in our own environment. And if we don't, as I said earlier, if we don't really start here at home with educating and building America's voice here, we are simply, there is no way, I think, and I'm not, you know, sort of the fall of Rome or anything, projecting that way, but I think that we should learn from the fall of Rome. You know, that we need to really do a lot of self-education here at home if we're really going to be effective and understand how we deal both in the public sector as well as in the private sector, and be thinking, I mean, I'm personally very worried right now that we seem to have such a polarized situation in Congress and in society, and that bipartisanship is sort of not the natural order of things right now. And it's more than just a specific policy. It is, I think, a way that, you know, people are encouraged in some ways to be polarizing. A very we and they sort of attitude, and it's very troubling, I find.
I have a question about your thoughts on the long-term effects of changing administrations and opposition and participation in, like, the UN. I've been reading how Clinton had signed the Millennium
Right. Well, I'm trying desperately, really I am, to not be very partisan in all of this. But I mean, I clearly, you know, full disclosure, as Jumana said, I mean, I do come out of a Democratic history, big D, in terms of the work that I've done. But I think one of the things that people do understand is that different people are elected in this country, and very often policies change as new presidents particularly come in to office. There had, I would say though, always been a tradition on foreign policy of much more continuity, in my view, and based on what I've read and what I understand, than I think has been the case in this particular administration. Nixon, Johnson, Nixon, you know, fill in the blank, Ford, whatever. I mean, Reagan, you know, Panama Canal treaties passed under Carter. He didn't try to upend that, and he was very much against the Panama Canal treaties before he, you know, as someone who was in the Clinton, in the Carter administration, and that was sort of one of the things I was working on. I mean, Reagan was one of the most vociferous articulators against the treaties. But there was a bipartisan sort of modality that operated from administration to administration. I find some of what has happened in the last few, you know, this last period troubling. And, you know, I do think there are shifts in policy, but they seem to me to be more abrupt and more jerky. And jerky, I mean, in the sense of sort of, you know, zigzag. Than they have been in the past, and I do think it has confused publics abroad. I do believe that this is basically a much more ideological administration than many have been. Certainly, FDR was accused of that in terms of court packing the Supreme Court and all of that, that it was, you know, very ideological. And indeed, he was, he didn't get what he wanted in terms of expanding the court. But we have a situation which has not been the case. I think maybe it was but even then it wasn't all, I'll finish my thought. We have a Republican Congress now. We have one-party government right now, Congress and the administration. And we really, I don't think, have had that with all three, with the two houses and the White House that I can remember. And it has been that way for a while. So it is very difficult. I mean, Jamie Gorelick was saying this morning that one of the questions was, well, how do you really have how do you move things forward if one of the things that the Democrats are doing, this was a question sort of related to the Supreme Court, but about foreign policy appointments, when the instinct seems to be to put a hold on things, which, as you know, senators can do. Well, you know, I mean, she sort of said this is troubling, but one of the issues is that there are no other tools that the minority has right now. So holds are sort of the one way they're able to sort of hold literally things up for a period of time. I don't think we have the most functioning government right now in terms of decision making. And as somebody who actually, I mean, I did run a bipartisan coalition a number of years ago. It was called the New England Congressional Caucus, and it was Republicans and Democrats. And part of it was identifying issues around which there could be bipartisan support. And there were certainly disagreements among people of one party, much less people of both parties. But the idea was to sort of shape a consensus. And I know that there is often the concern that, you know, then everything just becomes pablum. You know, it just, everything, it's all center and there are no, you know, there are no strong views and people sort of lose their identity or issues. I don't think, I mean, I don't really subscribe to that. I think that, sure, there are things that may come out that way, without question. But basically, I think you come out with better policy. I think that you're looking for consensus, and this is a country built around consensus. And you know, personally, I believe the Constitution must be a living document, or we'd still be, you know, separate, you know, separate but equal. I mean, you know, it does change. Times change, you know, we need to be cognizant. I mean, you're the lawyers here; I'm not, but I mean, cognizant of you know, of basic principles, but also appreciative of the times that, you know, we live in, or there wouldn't be. I mean, we'd still be, you know, having the Torah, you know, sort of Japanese, you know, movies from World War II. I mean, things change. And I think if there's anything that we've learned over these last, the sort of post-Cold War, is that former enemies can be friends. And we've learned it not through war, but through peaceful change. And, you know, whether we like or don't like certain things about Russia and Putin and the government or whatever, the fact is that there are ways of communicating and ways of working out issues that don't have to resort to violence. And of course, I think one of the big issues that we face as a country, but also we face globally, is how do we deal with what seems to have become, you know, an active, accepted methodology of action, which is violence, and violence on massive scales, and not just here, but in Bali, and, you know, I mean, it's a very, the definition of rogue was different 10 years ago than it is today. Because at least as bad as it may be, you know, rogue states are different. There is some structure, at least, that you're trying to deal with, and then, as troublesome as that may be, then sort of rogue personalities or rogue groups that don't seem to subscribe to any kind of, you know, you're sort of looking for some basic sort of modalities. Thank you for coming. I don't know what you do about a Bolton, but clearly if the administration did not want him to follow the policies that he's ascribing to or stating, then he wouldn't be in the position. And they are, and, you know, my response would be maybe in 2006 there'll be a change in Congress, so there'll be different kinds of pressures that will result in some of those things not happening, or there'll be changes in 2008, but or the world will, you know, some event will change issues. I mean, it was very interesting, I thought, in the I just saw, of course, there are polls up the wazoo every 2 seconds, but there was some poll I just read about Louisiana, and that while people very upset and very concerned and very troubled by what happened, they don't really, it hasn't really changed the perceptions on whether that was an effect. Actually, it didn't change the perception that that had anything to do with global warming. Even though there's been a tremendous amount written about, you know, was this, you know, sort of somehow you're saying no, but I'm just saying. But it's interesting because it has, people have, perceptions do not change overnight. And I think we have to understand that. I mean, autocracies don't become democracies, you know, in a flash of a moment. It took Weimar for Hitler to, you know, become who he was and for the government to change. And And, you know, clearly we went to war, and hopefully that will not be the way, which again goes back to why soft power and these kinds of ways of acting are so very important, I think. Anyway, yes, yes.
I'm a little confused by the split between public policy and public diplomacy and the neutral stance that you take towards public policy. How do you separate the American values you're trying to get out there from our public policy, especially when they seem to be in direct contradiction?
Well, I get... I'm sorry, excuse me. I would say, and I heard myself say public policy. I think public policy is the United States has certain policies. Those are the policies. Public diplomacy should be part of the public policy process as it is formulated, as it is decided. And at the end of that, there may be a policy that is agreed upon that let's say, you know, Karen Hughes is sitting at the table and she says, you know, we should be considering A, B, C, D, and E, and someone says, well, we've considered A, B, C, D, and E and have come to the conclusion that this should be the policy. What I'm saying is that I think there are people who then have the responsibility of going out and selling, articulating, communicating that policy as the president, as John Bolton, as people do every day in the administration, and elsewhere, who are part, you know, who agree with those policies, and it should be articulated. And clearly, that is the policy of the United States. I mean, we are a government of laws, and that's what the law is. What I'm saying, though, is that I think the Karen Hughes responsibility is to go out and say, this is the policy of the United States. This is how it was formulated. I don't mean telling tales out of school about, you know, Joe Jones said this in the deliberations. But this is our policy. But this is how America functions. Let me explain to you. And no, there are a lot of people who don't agree with that policy. There has been real dialogue in the United States, or real disagreement. It is by dialogue and not by sort of diktat that we have concluded. George Bush, had he been elected, Al Gore, had he been elected, might have had a different approach, and I presume would have. But we elected George Bush. This is the policy of the United States. But I think that the public diplomat's role, the public diplomacy function, is a different function than the spokesman function. And I think it is more of a dialogue function. I don't expect Sean McCormick at the State Department to go out and say, when he is, you know, going around with Condi Rice, well, you know, I think there may be some issues here on our Iraq policy. He has a policy, and I was a deputy spokesman at the State Department, and, you know, come hell or high water, that was the policy. I had guidance. I stayed within certain guidances. But I think that there is another function, and I think in part it's a listening function, and I think it's an explaining function, and it's a culturally sensitive function. And to me, that is part of the importance of what America is, that we can have somebody who goes out and says, well, you know, there are others, we have a system of government here where people disagree. And even though that may be the policy, they can still, you know, protest in the street or, you know, whatever. Does that explain what I'm trying to say? And I'm not saying it is easy to do that, but I think it is important, and I think it is essential. Otherwise, I don't think we need somebody who is the head of public diplomacy. I think then, you know, that job should be part of the spokesman function at the State Department. and let's just call it what it is. Which is not necessarily a two-way street, other than in camera when the discussions are taking place. But once that person gets in front of the press corps, he, she has, you know, articulates a certain thing. I think that's different than Karen Hughes. And I think, I mean, I don't know, the trip seems to have been a mixed success that she just went on, at least according to the press. I mean, to me, there are, and I'm not saying she didn't discuss them, but I think there are more important issues than whether or not women should drive in Saudi Arabia, which seemed to, I mean, maybe that just captured the attention of the press and that's what they wrote about. But I think there are different messages. I've done a lot of work with a group called Vital Voices, which does a lot of training and working with women in the developing world, and you know, everything from communications and leadership training and media training, and but part of it is basic things is understanding how you build coalitions. I mean, these are people who, you know, don't, you know, it's understanding the concept and that there are other people who they can work with in these societies. It's putting together a civil society. And I believe that if those things are done, which is why it's so important to have free trade and open up societies, blogging and the internet and all of that, definitionally you get different views because it just will, I mean, it, as we know, I mean, there's just too much out there, too much information. I mean, you have to, something has to creep in which says, well, gee, you know, other people think other things. And to me, that's one of, beyond the economic main chance, that's one of the great things that we have to sell about this country, is that there is this opportunity to converse, to have differences of opinion, to meet people of different nationalities and, you know, all of that. And that, to me, is what the American voice and vision is much more about than whether, you know, I mean, well, as you say, than whether or not we did or didn't do the right thing about Iraq. I don't necessarily expect her to get up there and say, you know, the president misspoke or whatever about his policy, whatever the euphemism would be. But I think to say that, you know, that I understand that there are a lot of people who disagree with what our policy is, I've never heard that being articulated in quite that way, at least, you know, in terms of what I see as this function.
Maybe have any other questions? I think people have to always, I don't know, I have people talk.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry.
So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all for staying and taking the time.